From 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, it's The Build. Conversations with entrepreneurs and innovators about their dreams, their triumphs, and their challenges.
Press. That word means two things to this week's guest. It's what you use to make your dress trousers look great, and that's the kind of look that Tom Cridland envisioned when he borrowed about $10,000 to launch his clothing line. And while stars like Daniel Craig wore his fashion out on the town, Tom found even more success with the 30-year sweatshirt, a casual piece that's designed to last far, far longer than the typical fast fashion item. However, getting the kind of press Tom needed to launch his brand, attention from fashion magazines, newspapers, and bloggers, proved a little daunting for London's establishment publicists. So Tom spun up his own process to land stories about his crowdfunded fashions on TV networks and in publications around the world. He's been so successful, his shop on the King's Road in London's Chelsea neighborhood now doubles as a PR firm that helps other fashion entrepreneurs get their own press. It's the story of Tom Cridland, coming up next on The Build.
The Build is made possible with support from 2820 Press, providing business consulting and content strategy services to customer-obsessed companies nationwide. More information at 2820press.com.
It's The Build. I'm Joe Taylor, Jr., and in just 2 years of operations, the Tom Cridland clothing line's been racking up attention from fashion journalists all over the world. That's because the company's namesake founder isn't afraid to call up an influencer who could share his story. And so I caught up with Tom on his mobile phone in between meetings in London. Tom Cridland, welcome to The Build.
Thanks for having me.
So I love the story. Tell me a little bit. 2 years ago, at around this time, you are looking to get started with the company, and you start with a loan of £6,000. It's about $10,000 based on today's exchange rate. And you decide to kick off with what? What's your next step after securing the financing?
Well, yeah, it was around this time in 2014. That I had secured that financing of £6,000 from the government-subsidized startup loan scheme. And I'd already had the plan of creating a menswear brand, e-commerce brand, focusing solely on trousers. So we were just going to make trousers and chinos, and that was going to be our only product, basically, in lots of different styles. And that's what we started with for the first year. And things really took off when we had the chance to make trousers, which was the result of me being plucky. But we had the chance to make some trousers and chinos for the likes of Daniel Craig, Leonardo DiCaprio, Hugh Grant, Ben Stiller, Rod Stewart, the Elton John band. And that was from me contacting their management. And I couldn't have imagined how much interest there'd be from some of my heroes, and also how gracious they were. You know, for example, Elton John's drummer Nigel is a very good friend of mine now, and it's been, you know, that side of things was a dream come true. But that was the initial idea, just trousers only, and it was after that we diversified.
And so by diversifying, I think what we may be familiar with over here in the U.S. is the concept of the 30-year sweatshirt and the 30-year jacket. Tell me a little bit about how you came across this idea to actually build fashion that lasts.
Well, I thought it would be an interesting thing because there are a lot of people who live and breathe sustainable fashion, environmentalists or people who are concerned about the durability of clothing, or people who are simply concerned about maybe the lack of training that some people whose job is to put together clothing nowadays, you know, do they have any training? What expertise do they have? Do they care about the clothing that they're putting together? These are all the concerns that fast fashion raise. And I thought that it would be interesting to launch a project that was appealing broadly to most people, and that was a bit more lighthearted, but got people talking about and thinking about the way in which they consume fashion. And so together with my suppliers in Portugal, I developed the concept of the 30-year sweatshirt based on how long, in their experience, because they've been making clothing for over 50 years, just based on their experience of how long a sweatshirt could really be guaranteed to last. And they reckon it would be about 30, 40 years. So we stuck to the lower end. And I always knew that it would be called the something year sweatshirt. And so that's how we came up with the 30-year sweatshirt.
And so the thing I found pretty interesting is that you chose Portugal based on some knowledge based on your family, right? You've got Portuguese lineage.
Yes.
Because it's not necessarily the first place that Americans would look to get clothing from. We typically hire out to China, India, Bangladesh. But it sounds like the story you're telling includes a lot of recapturing this idea of craftsmanship in the work that you found among the Portuguese vendors.
Well, it's absolutely that. And you know, I'll make no bones about the fact that I've had a production run in China before, and it cost us more money than it cost us in Portugal, and the quality was twice as bad. You know, by the time if you're a small independent brand, it's one thing if you're J. Crew or whoever it is, and you're getting okay quality, and you're able to negotiate on shipping, and you've got lots of money in the bank. But if you're an independent brand like mine, getting it made closer to home makes sense. I mean, if I could make it in Britain, that would be wonderful. But, you know, as I'm half Portuguese, half British, the next place I looked was Portugal. I mean, I think there is a tradition of excellent craftsmanship across Europe. And I run a business with my girlfriend of 6 years. She's just stopped working at Universal Music to be our managing director full-time. And she's half Italian. So we're even maybe looking at moving production over to Italy now.
Fantastic.
And that might be more expensive, but I know the quality might even be a further step up. And you know, I'm in this obviously to make a living, but I'm also in this to create like products that I'm really, really proud of, because it's got my name on. And I was initially a bit reluctant about naming the brand after me, but on the other hand, you know, it was great for buying the domain. There weren't too many people called Tom Cridland queuing up.
Well, there's no motivation like having your name on the door, right? If something goes wrong, people know exactly who to complain to.
Absolutely, I still get the same rush if, you know, we ever have an article or anything, and it's not a nice article, then I obviously feel really happy. But at the same time, if anything goes wrong, then I'm really upset. And so this is a real labor of love for me and for my girlfriend, and you know, we really pour our heart and soul into it. And I'm not going to pretend that we haven't made mistakes, but we've always had like the best of intentions. We always work as hard as we possibly can, and I know that with that attitude, we're only going to be able to move forward and make things even better than we do already. So it's a really great situation.
So 2 years into this evolution of the business, and you are competing with some of the brands that you mentioned, J. Crew, Gap, Primark, some of the large global retailers. How do you get your customers to shift away from this idea of inexpensive instant gratification into investing a little bit more for that quality workmanship and for something that's going to last?
Well, I think at this point it's people who are interested. It's people who have a vested interest in either the uniqueness of our designs. Even though we make staples, there are little things about our designs that are unique. Or they're interested in our buy less, buy better philosophy. We will have had to catch their attention at this point. You know, it's not like we're competing in terms of sales with any of those brands, but we are, you know, at least causing a little bit of a stir. You know, nothing big, but you know, some people have noticed, and that's wonderful. And you know, we're at a slightly awkward price point, really. We're trying to do in fashion what in America people like Great Brand have done with sneakers, or Harry's have done with shaving. We're trying to do that with fashion, and we don't have anywhere near the level of investment that they started with. We only started with the equivalent of $10,000. So, and you know, I'm imagining the people at Harry's and Great. I mean, some of them had previous ventures that were successful. Some of them were in their, you know, 30s. And you know, we're very young, straight out of university, with less funding. But that was our inspiration in terms of, we want to be part of the future. Physical retail is on the decline, and we want to do something really special with clothing. And we want to make the basics. We want to make the stuff that a lot of people buy, and we want to inject some personality and sort of like, you know, a decent code into how we make it.
So when you say that physical retail is on the decline, how does that inform your decision to open up an actual retail shop in London?
Well, that was based on the fact that we were approached and we were given a deal that we couldn't turn down. and it's a wonderful opportunity. But this shop front in London is simply, if I'm being quite frank, another publicity stunt, and also, you know, because we couldn't turn down the deal because it was so good, it was a wonderful opportunity. You know, creatively, it's been a joyous experience to kind of extend our brand and our brand's personality into a physical retail space. In terms of sales and in terms of like our business strategy, opening this physical retail location was never something that was informed by business strategy or business thinking, money making. It was only because it was an excellent deal and because it was a creative, you know, wonderful creative experience, and obviously such a huge adrenaline rush to have such a wonderful place in London.
Well, I think it would also give you a sense of credibility among potential customers that there's a physical place. I think there's still a little bit of hesitation for some consumers that want to shop but don't necessarily know where the product comes from or where the people stand behind their brand.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, it was really, you know, it was a no-brainer. But that's not to say, you know, you're right. It's the credibility. The sales are still going to be made online, though.
And so along those lines, coming back to the funding, you had that initial startup loan. Have you taken any investment, or are you completely bootstrapping at this point?
I wouldn't say that we're bootstrapping, but we are achieving our results simply through organic growth. We've taken no further investment, no further bank loans. We've given away no equity. We've just continued to grow organically. And it's taken a huge amount of resilience to be able to do that. And there have obviously been moments early on where we came close to thinking, you know, is this the right idea to start a clothing brand? What are we doing? But it's you know, been smooth for quite a while now. And we're learning as we go along. And, you know, if nothing else, it's a wonderful experience.
So it sounds like one of the big things that you learned along the way was how to tell your story effectively to journalists. And one thing that I observe is that, Tom, you're not afraid to pick up the phone or send an email to anybody that you feel like can help tell your story. What do you think, you know, knowing now that you're actually advising other startups, other fashion entrepreneurs, why do you think people are afraid to reach out? What do you try to coach new entrepreneurs about telling their story that maybe they haven't heard before?
Well, I try and emphasize that in today's day, you know, in the world that we live in now, there's so much content, there's so many stories, there's social media platforms. For example, print advertising doesn't work in the way that it used to. If you got an advertisement out in the New York Times or the Sunday Times in England or wherever it was, in the old days, and you saved up and you shelled out whatever it was, 10 grand for an advertisement, you'd expect some results and you'd almost be certain to get some results out of it. Now, you cannot predict that. You've got to get press, whether it be small blogs or whether it be big national newspapers or magazines or go on the radio, go on TV, whatever you can do. You need to get your name out there and you need to do it every month. That's just an essential part of life. And maybe some people are put off because, quite frankly, some journalists are very conceited and obviously very busy. And you get a lot of rude responses. But I don't care. You know, I'm doing my job. And most decent journalists respect that. And as a result, we've been featured in a lot of places. So I'm not going to be afraid. The situation is that I need to get press for us to grow as a brand. And so I'm going to pitch for it and I'm going to try and earn it. And I always pitch in a very polite way. And I just try and lay out the story as simply as I can. And in a way that people, you know, are going to see my email and they're not going to be like, oh, you know, God, that's a long email. I can't really be bothered to read that. Delete. I try and at least capture people's imagination. And I'm sure it gets deleted 90% of the time, but we do manage to capture people's attention, and we use exactly the same attitude and the same method with our clients as part of Tom Fridland Public Relations, and we've been effective. But we're not we're an agency that people approach based on my own track record. I'm not going to go around shouting from the hilltops what press I've got for other people, because the whole point is that I want I want people to know maybe that I'm working with people only based on the writing style of the pitches. Some people might be able to work it out. Otherwise, it will be signed off. Anything that my clients send is signed off as them. Because I know that journalists prefer to speak to the actual founder or the boss or the person behind the business, not some third-party PR.
And I find that really compelling because in some of the work that we've done with clients, we find the same thing. One of the adages that you hear a lot, especially in places like Silicon Valley, is figure out how to sell your runoff. And in this case, the runoff was you developed a process that worked very well for getting attention for your brand, and you've actually turned that into a second business, which is the public relations practice. So how did you end up in that situation? Were brands contacting you, or did you start to highlight people that you wanted to work with? How did you decide to start curating
a client? Well, the process of starting the business, it was twofold. On the one hand, I drew up a list of some people that I wanted to work with, and I contacted them, and I listed what press I'd done and told them a bit about me in a very simple way. And then on the other hand, I thought, well, if I'm starting a new business, just like with the Tom Cridland fashion label, I'm going to need to get some press. So we got an article in Forbes about how I'd started my own PR agency, and then we got a lot of inquiries off the back of that. And I'm not going to do too much more promotion for the public relations agency because we get most of our inquiries now on referral or on people who've seen the Forbes article. And PR-wise, it's more important to get press for the fashion business.
Yeah, absolutely.
And back to the public relations practice, I mean, we only started it at the end of November, and we've already got some clients on a referral basis after 2 months of working for them. And I don't think there are many public relations practices who can say the same.
The thing that I love about this is because I often tell folks that with the right amount of discipline, you can effectively manage your own campaigns. You didn't go to school for public relations or communications.
No.
This is all from the trial and error in figuring out how to build your own brand. And now you're making that a service for other brands that you feel that you can make a difference for.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell me a little bit about what the Tom Cridland enterprise looks like in 10 years. How do you grow all of these disparate parts of your business into something that sounds like it's already on the path of becoming a substantial brand?
Well, I'm more of an ideas guy. I'm good at the promo and I'm good at the PR stuff. In terms of growing the business, you know, my girlfriend has a master's degree from London Business School, and it's going to be more her wheelhouse to plan the numbers and plan our strategy business-wise in terms of how we grow. You know, I'm an ideas guy, so I've got all sorts of, schemes that I'm already brewing, you know, for future projects and even future ways of diversifying the business. But I basically just want to continue to do things like we're doing now as effectively as possible, as transparently as possible, just doing things as well as we possibly can and injecting a bit of personality in proceedings, not being afraid to say what we think, not being afraid to go out there and pitch for press and just working as hard as we can. You know, we're very energetic, so, I feel like we're getting a lot done and quite quickly.
Tell me a little bit about how you capture ideas and how you determine whether an idea is worth pursuing.
I just thought with the amount of press that we're getting, and I thought it was surprisingly impressive for a startup, and I thought that there would certainly be a way of diversifying that and creating another business out of it and we didn't have a PR agency, we didn't have a marketing budget, we didn't pay anyone to get this PR. This was all us, all of our effort, and I don't think without blowing my own trumpet, I don't think there are a lot of people out there who could have achieved that. And so, people who become accountants and lawyers, they spend 3 years, they qualify, they prove that they're able to carry out a service for people, and then they start charging people fees at a market rate, and that's how they make a living. And, I feel like I've done my qualification and I've earned something that can prove my track record when it comes to promoting, when it comes to getting press, with no budget. And so I use that and I monetize it in the same way that a lawyer or an accountant would. So that's how that idea came about. And you know, the interest was overwhelming on that front. But everything's been overwhelming so far. And you know, I still go into it the same. You know, everything's a thrill, everything's a surprise.
So tell me a little bit about how you intend to scale the business. If you've got your girlfriend who's taking on the business and numbers and the operational end of it, what kinds of people do you want to attract to your team? How do you fill up a company with more people that share your passion for coming up with great ideas?
Well, the next person that we're going to hire is going to be somebody to handle logistics and customer service. So we're taking the hiring for that very seriously. I mean, I'm going to need to know these people personally, or at least get to know them personally. You know, not socially necessarily, but I'm going to need to know that I can trust them. And I'm going to need to know that they're happy to stay up late and work properly. And yeah, it's going to be difficult. Because at the moment, it's just us and, you know, we're building our lives together and we care very passionately about it. And I know that we're both putting in 110%. So it's very, very difficult to know who on earth we can supplement the team with. I mean, we've obviously got part-timers in the shop and we've got other people, but we've had lots of applications for free internships. But instead, I've chosen to hire my brother, who's just graduated from university and is starting a full-time job in September. So he's managing the shop. And then I've got another friend working, and then another friend when we go on our promotional tour of America, he'll be our driver. So it's just friends and family at the moment.
So tell me about the promotional tour of America. Where are you going? What's your goal?
We're going to New York for about a week, and then we're going to Los Angeles for 3 weeks. And the goal is really to speak to journalists and speak to press who are not willing to cover our story unless we're there to take a face-to-face interview. I'm also going to be announcing a few dates at some universities where I'm going to be speaking to entrepreneurial societies in Los Angeles and around California. And we will maybe have a few more promotional things up our sleeves when we're out there. And then we're going to take a well-earned break and go to Hawaii for the weekend.
Nice. Since you're in the neighborhood, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do you think it takes to crack the American market? Do you foresee working with retail distributors over here, or do you continue to just go forward with this direct sales-to-customer strategy?
I think we will continue to build our brand as an e-commerce brand, because that's what I believe is the future. We're happy if retailers get in touch, but we've already had some big-name retailers get in touch, and we've had to turn them down in the end. So people would have to make us a very attractive offer.
And you're turning them down because of what? Volume?
Because the markups just don't work, because we make our clothing well, and I'm not prepared to outsource it to places that don't make it well. So that's basically why it doesn't work. The numbers simply don't work. Also, I find the attitude of retailers to be somewhat condescending in my experience. You know, being a buyer at a big department store or something is an impressive thing. It doesn't mean that all other brands should kind of be looked down on. And I certainly don't need their help. And there are many other independent brands like mine who only sell direct to customer, and the customers get a fairer deal out of it. So in a way, it would kind of be against our ethos. I'm not going to pretend that I wouldn't be absolutely thrilled to be stopped somewhere like Harrods in London or Saks Fifth Avenue or something like that. But I just don't know whether the numbers would ever work.
Well, I think you called out an example in Harry's. You know, anyone who listens to a podcast in the United States is familiar with Harry's because they sponsor, it seems, almost every podcast. The same idea applies. Typical retail markup is between 4 and 10 times the cost of production. And so your price points are actually fairly competitive now with brands like L.L. Bean here in America. If you were to go into some place like Nordstrom, which would be nice in terms of putting the brand in front of buyers, but you'd probably have to at least double the retail price.
Yeah. I just don't know whether that would be viable. I mean, again, maybe that's something for my girlfriend to look at, but I want to give customers a fair deal. And I like not having vultures breathing down our necks. You know, this is our business, and we will do things how we like, and we'll try and do them fairly. And the minute we start getting other people involved, you know, they'll have all sorts of agendas.
So if there's one thing that you would tell an entrepreneur, and it sounds like some American entrepreneur students will get to experience this on your roadshow, but if someone comes to you and asks for advice, what's the one thing that a first-time entrepreneur needs to do right out of the gate to make their business a success?
I would just say don't give up, and if someone comes out with advice that basically is belittling or makes it subtly seem like your idea is stupid or that you should completely change your approach, don't necessarily take what they say as gospel. Times change. People who are giving you advice now, that advice might have worked 30 years ago. You don't know whether it's going to work now. Believe in yourself and just don't give up. And make sure you're having a nice life as well. You know, I mean, work late and be very, very passionate. You know, you've got to work hard and you've got to earn it, or you'll know whether you are. And, you know, I struggle to balance it at the moment because I'm loving work and I'm, you know, desperate to try and, you know, capture this opportunity and strike while the iron's hot and establish ourselves as a big brand. I don't care if we become a really big brand. I just want to, you know, have a good life, make a good living and try and produce great clothing that people enjoy. That's all I care about.
That sounds great. Tom Cridland, thanks for making time to speak with us on The Build.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The Build is a production of 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Our producer is Lori Taylor. Our associate producer is Katie Cohen-Zonizer. Our talent coordinators are Katrina Smith and Ghazem Yali. And our post-production team is led by Evan Wilder at Flowly Audio in Detroit. My name is Joe Taylor Jr. Thanks for listening to The Build.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Build. We hope you'll share this series with your friends and provide us with feedback on the iTunes Store. You can also subscribe to weekly updates and learn more about upcoming guests by visiting our show page at thebuild.biz. This has been a 2820 Radio production.